Chapter 1, The Storyteller.
Eric said he was.
Yeah, that's right. Were you an employee or are you now?
A former employee.
Former employee.
I was let go on a medical discharge about a week ago, and I've kind of been running across the country. Oh man, I don't know where to start. They'll triangulate on this position really, really soon.
So you can't spend a lot of time on the phone. So give us something quick.
Okay. Okay. What we're thinking of as aliens are they're extra dimensional beings that an earlier precursor of the space program made contact with. They are not what they claim to be. They have infiltrated a lot of aspects of the military establishment, particularly the Area 51. The disasters that are coming, the military, I'm sorry, the government knows about them. And there's a lot of safe areas in this world that they could begin moving the population to now, Art.
But they're not doing anything.
They are not. They want the major population centers wiped out so that the few that are left will be more easily controllable. I started getting...
I first heard this on a cassette shortly after it aired in 1997. I was 14. And living in my family home in the forests of North Vancouver Island, we were the last driveway at the end of a gravel road. Our house was in the woods among tall Douglas firs, deep salal, and crown land that was occasionally logged. It was the kind of remoteness that made you sit up and take notice if a car randomly drove down the road. My grandparents lived in a house at the back of our 8 acres, and my parents, brothers, and I lived at the front. My brothers and I would go and visit my grandparents all the time, and sometimes my grandma would pop in a cassette for us to listen to. Not music. She listened to Coast AM with Art Bell. It still is a call-in radio show that focuses on the supernatural, but now the host has changed. Back then, it aired at midnight our time, and my grandma would tape episodes that she thought were particularly good for us to listen to when we came over. It's tape like that that made a real impact on me, although The Summer of Freezer Freddy also played its part in my education of extraterrestrials and conspiracy theories that all underpinned why we could never trust the government. One night a guy called in claiming to be Dr. Jonathan Reed. He said he'd come across a black obelisk in the forest while walking his dog.
All of a sudden I saw her engaged with what looked to me at the time like a small size dimension figure, very dark, almost black, and it was the size of a child.
He claimed there was an alien there that attacked his dog, so he fought back and whacked it on the head with a branch.
And I wanted to kill it.
Mm-hmm.
It screamed, I screamed, I think in triumph of trying to stop what I was witnessing, but I almost missed it. I mean, I'm not an athlete. I'm 190 pounds, and but I almost didn't hit it. But as I struck it, its head, it started to fall down. The branch had breached its skull. It had broken its skull.
So
this
thing was definitely solid. Right?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean,
he took it home and put it in his freezer, obviously.
I literally just opened the top of the freezer and lowered it down and thought, it's out of sight, out of mind, and now I'm going to go in the house and stand in the shower.
And this was over your meats and frozen?
No, there wasn't much in that freezer. There was a separate rack that I just took out that had some frozen things, you know, and I didn't care. I wanted it out of my sight.
And then some trouble started for him.
After 9 days of having this hell in my house and having my life torn apart, I left the country. I left the United States. I went to Canada because I didn't want my friends, my family, to continue to be harassed. They were burning effigies in their lawns. They were, you know, screaming at them on the phone. There were trucks driving through people's yards. I mean, you name it.
Wait, doctor. All the commotion you just talked about could only come if the news was out, but good.
Well, the news was out enough so that all of my friends were now being threatened.
Okay.
So there was enough people, I call them the dark side, who had basically taken over.
I know the dark
side. Decided to.
Do you hear that? The way Art Bell primes his caller, he teased that story out to a 3-hour show. 3 hours. He was a master of talk radio. He knew what to say to get the best out of his callers. In the case of Freezer Freddy, there's serious doubt on the internet about whether or not Dr. Jonathan Reed is a real person or a man adopting a false identity to make money from speaking fees and book sales. Maybe not all of Art Bell's guests were telling the truth, but many of the fans were in it for real. My grandma was one of those fans, and I may not have loved the show back then, but I really appreciate it now. The show was a lifeline for people who didn't trust the government, who thought we were being lied to en masse about everything, from chlorine in the water to chemtrails. Then I'd walk home through the woods in the dark, hoping that if I encountered anything, it would be the bear that lived in our backyard, and not a tractor beam of light from a flying saucer, slowly and methodically searching the forest for a young human to abduct and test. I always made it home, but sometimes I turned off the flashlight to make it harder for potential aliens to locate me, assuming they relied on my feeble light source. I would walk through the dark woods with the sounds of frogs, crickets, and owls around me. If the moon was out, I could see the path well enough. If I was lucky, I would have a dog with me. I'm not worried about alien abduction anymore. I live in a city, and there are more pressing earthly matters I'm concerned with. But when aliens or UFOs or flying saucers come up in conversation, I have a hard time writing off the true believers, the people who report sightings or abductions, the people who have a reason to believe, because I think they have a need to believe. I'm Liz MacArthur, and this is Beam Me Up. Chapter 2, The Voyager. This year I heard a story that brought me back to the summer of Freezer Freddy. It was the story of a friendly, down-to-earth guy who disappeared one stormy night. He left a note saying he was going on a journey through space. His name is Granger Taylor, and he was from Duncan, just north of Victoria, where I live now. Granger Taylor was an outgoing, friendly young man who had a brilliant mind for mechanics. He was also obsessed with UFOs. He built one in his yard in North Cowichan and would climb inside to spend hours reading about the potential for extraterrestrial life. In 1980, he left a note for his parents saying he was going on a 42-month journey with alien beings who had contacted him. He disappeared that night during a storm, leaving his parents distraught. Derek Zedenius covered the story for the Times Colonist newspaper when Taylor initially disappeared.
Hello.
Hi, is this Derek?
Oh, hi. Is this Elizabeth, eh?
Yeah, it is. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. So I have my recorder running, just so you know, as long as that's okay with you.
Yeah, you can do what you want.
Okay, great. So you were working at the Times Colonist at the time you wrote the story, is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. And you wrote the story a little bit after the fact. So can you tell me how you sort of became aware of it and why you decided to write that story?
Well, I mean, it was quite a bit after the fact because they'd waited like 51 months, I think, expecting Granger to return. So, like, he went missing in November 1980, and I got the story in 1985. And somebody—I can't recall how it came about, but this story came in, or I'd heard about it somehow. That there was this family who had their son had gone off and on a UFO, and of course it's intriguing. You have to follow up on a case like that because there's so many unanswered parts to it, just what happened to him and so on and so forth. Mm. So, yeah, I'm not too sure exactly how I got the story, but it was the kind of story that I love to investigate anyway.
Mm-hmm. So did you go up to Duncan and talk to his
parents?
Oh,
yeah, sure. I spent a day or two in Duncan talking to the parents and to some people who knew Granger. I didn't have a whole lot of time to spend on it because there are a number of stories going on, but the certainly toured the little farm or the place where Granger lived and saw his room. And yeah, I can still remember that day very clearly. They had sort of preserved everything for him in anticipation that he'd be coming home. But of course, the hopes were beginning to fade, you know. But they still had no satisfaction as to what exactly happened. And
I was reading when I was sort of initially searching for information on Granger. I found a lot of articles about about reported sightings on Vancouver Island, which I had never really heard of before, but there were like sort of a rash of them during that time.
Yeah, there were lots, and I think in that little story we noted that there had been about 20 sightings of, but I never kept a record of the number, but there were a lot, yeah, and some of these were discounted, of course, but some of them were not explained. But
can you tell me what Granger's room looked like? Can you remember it?
Well, it was just a room in a fairly small. His primary interest, of course, was in science fiction and UFOs and things like that. And today, if somebody came along, you might look at this person and say, perhaps he displayed some of the qualities or temperament characteristics of somebody with Asperger's, you know. And, you know, there have been a number of very famous people, scientists and so on, with similar kinds of characteristics. And it's very, very common for people with that syndrome to be tremendously interested in science fiction and maybe relive it, you know.
Did you see the flying saucer that he made in his yard? Was that still there?
Oh, yeah, of course it was still there. Still there, and even his sofa was in there, and this was like 4 years later, and kids had been playing in it, and it was in a bit of a state of disrepair. I don't think the parents really knew what to do, you know. They were just hoping that he would come back, and wanted everything to remain. But Granger himself, I think, had indicated that he would be just going on this trip and that he would be returning, but of course he never did. And I had left the newspaper a couple of years later. They discovered some wreckage on Mount Sicker, and they believed that that was Granger's truck, and possibly he had believed that he might have committed suicide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the books that he was reading. Did you see like some of the books or titles when you were there?
Yeah, I did, and I have to, you know, they're really just on flying saucers, black holes, the secret forces of the pyramid, and flying saucers here and now, and from outer space, and there's a whole box of them, you know, and those were. Hmm. A sampling, and clearly he was fascinated with the with that genre of literature. You know, he had tons of those books. You got to be careful. The internet's full of these strange stories, and you got to be careful that you about checking them out, because some of them are really wild, and you can't really rely totally on the information there. You know, you take it all with a little grain of salt.
Is there anything else that you'd like to say about reporting on this story, or what you think about Granger Taylor?
Well, not that, you know, I never met the man.
Yeah.
I never met him, that I was aware of, anyway. I wish you good luck in this.
Okay, thank you.
Have a great story.
Yeah, okay, bye-bye.
Take care, bye.
Speaking to people who knew Granger or who were alive at the time revealed a lot of mixed emotions. Family members warned me off. A woman who went to school with him said that they'd been paired together in class as dance partners because they were both social misfits in middle school. She said she had a speech impediment and was ostracized, and so she would pick him as a partner, and he was such a shy boy, he would always be grateful, and so they learned to dance together. She didn't want to take part in the documentary because those old wounds of being ostracized in school still run deep. I saw the property, though, where Granger Taylor lived. At the curve of a long road in North Cowichan, in the woods, is where the Taylor farm was. There's a grassy area where you had a cabin and all the cars he used to work on, cars and locomotives. And then there's an open space where he'd built the Flying Saucer. The Flying Saucer was sold years ago. Apparently it appeared in the classified ads as a liveaboard Flying Saucer. His sister had lived in a cabin near him on the property. She was a character in her own right. She built herself a wrestling ring and then challenged prominent wrestler at the time to a fight. I don't think it ever happened, though. She was also into guns, apparently, and old guns, like powder guns. And everyone at the school where she taught feared her. Chapter 3, The Photographer. One of the first things that came up while I was reading about Granger was a book called In Advance of the Landing, Folk Concepts of Outer Space, written by Douglas Curran, a photographer who now lives in Victoria. The excerpt I stumbled across was the most tangible source I'd found up to that point. It was referenced in some of the more sensational material. In the 70s, Doug spent nearly 8 years driving around North America, documenting folk depictions of flying saucers with his camera.
I bought a used Renault 16, which is an ugly duckling little car. Most people would never even know today what it is. And I ripped out the rear seat, and I built a desk behind the driver's seat on one side, and the passenger seat folded down to make into a bed, and with the glove box open, I had room for my feet. And I made a set of screen windows for the back so I could sleep in there without the boogeyman reaching in getting me at night. And I just started to drive, and I drove, and I drove. I put a CB radio in, so I'd get on. My handle was flashbulb. And I would ask people, I'd say, hey, I'm looking for people's ideas of outer space. I'm looking for people who've built a rocket or a flying saucer in their backyard. And I'd go into newspaper offices, I'd go to radio stations. A lot of it I just drove. And it was happenstance, and it was something would come. I'd make a decision to turn some way. I'd take a left fork down an abandoned road out in the desert, and suddenly there's a man living out there in an old motorhome, and he's painting a picture of an encounter of a flying saucer with an airliner. Okay. That's really what it was. It was being out. I lived in my car, and I moved. I talked. I'd talk to anybody.
He was studying photojournalism at Ryerson at the time, and in his last year told the school he'd register and pay fees, but he'd be out on the road working on his project.
Ryerson. And I said, I'm not going to come back in September. I want to be enrolled, but I'm going to go on the road, and I'm going to look for folk concepts of outer space. And they said, okay. And that's what I did.
At Ryerson, Doug studied the work of other photographers, but found himself increasingly influenced by the way George Orwell viewed and talked about pop culture.
He really looks and sees the value. He sees the social and cultural aspirations that are manifested through popular culture. And I saw this stuff, and it started changing my focus on things. Of instead of looking at popular culture as low culture, I started to see it as a kind of drama. I saw it as aspirational. I saw it as holding the kind of keys for people's inner aspirations. So that came along at one point, and along with that, reading Carl Jung. And Jung talked about archetypes, and a tremendous piece that I found actually after I'd started the book. But Jung said, all cultures create archetypes of deities, of supreme beings. And he said, in a culture, a technological culture such as ours, it would be no surprise to find that we shape supreme deities in a technological fashion.
As Doug traveled around the country looking for flying saucers to photograph, he encountered many people with varied reasons for building the saucers. As time passed, the way in which the people building these constructions were received and thought about by their neighbors also changed.
What I found, a number of people, for instance, a man, John Shepard, who lived in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. When I first met him, he was viewed as this wacko, this eccentric wacko living in a house. What John did actually is he converted his grandmother's house into a UFO detection station. Mm-hmm. And he was a completely self-taught electronics engineer. And he went in and he bought scrap and he bought surplus things and he created a massive pulsing generator that generated high voltage frequency signals that would crackle and zoop and whoop as it generated all these Gaussian electrode currents across itself. And he believed that he would communicate with aliens. And of course, when I first met him, which would have been about 1980 or 81, he was viewed as this wacko. But when I went back in like 5-6 years later, what was interesting was the way that the public perception in the town had changed, and he became an object of pride within the town and acceptance. So this talked about a whole societal change. A change in the idea of aliens contacting and being in communication with Earthlings. Then I'd say that in the later years, post-90, the phenomena changed again. And as our society became paranoid, you started seeing the reports. The aliens were no longer quite so benign. They were now doing biopsies and sampling humans and impregnating them and holding them captive on spaceships and inserting tracking things or metal beads and things up their nasal cavities. But this kind of aspect of surveillance and a kind of malevolence crept into it, which for me, I just start reading it in terms of our changes of our society.
One of the stops Doug made on his journey was in Duncan, where he visited the Taylor's home shortly after Granger went missing.
And when I came over, someone mentioned something about, they didn't know many details, but this guy who had disappeared. So I took myself from Shawnigan up to Duncan and went to the local newspaper and went through their archives, talked to a reporter, and worked my way over to the home of Granger Taylor's parents. So this was probably about 18 months after he had disappeared. And they were heartbroken. It was sad. There was an elderly couple who obviously cared and loved their son a great deal. And he disappeared one night in a violent windstorm after telling them that he was going away on a 42-month trip in a flying saucer, and disappeared. And they kept his bedroom, everything untouched, all of his tools, everything was left at that point waiting for him. I went back in 86 or 87, and they still had everything there untouched. I was able to talk to one close friend of his and, you know, people nearby at the cafe where he used to go. And again, he was seen as this eccentric kind of genius. You know, if you go online, you can read now, you know, pretty easily about him. At that point, it was more difficult. Again, this is pre-internet. Mm-hmm. Now everyone just borrows from everyone else in, you know, unascribed sources, as it were. But at that point, nobody knew where he was, what had happened. And, you know, things like, you know, the machines he'd worked in, you know, his bulldozer and the locomotive that he'd hauled out of the wood and rehabilitated and, you know, at this point is now part of the BC Lumber and Mining Museum. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, a place like Duncan, you know, where you've got a lot of sort of can-do, practical people. And even there, he stood out as being exceptional. He only had a grade 8 education. And he was this big, friendly guy, you know, 240 pounds, kind of like a big kid, friendly and welcoming to everyone. And so, he wasn't a hermit. And he was, I think, 28. And so, again, here's an odd story. Why? What? How did the belief get so entrenched that it filled his world? It completed his world for him. Hmm. You know, he wasn't a manic depressive. He wasn't a violent person. He wasn't somebody who rejected life. He very much was his own person. They didn't know what to think. And I think the kind of, I won't say ambivalent, but the unknowability and the lack of any proof of his death was something that, you know, as his father said, well, if there's anyone going to be taken up by aliens in a flying saucer, it'll be Granger. You know, that not knowing, like most things, that unknowability of it, the uncertainty of it, is more difficult to work around than, you know, than the fact or of someone's death.
Most of the stories in his book include interactions with the people who actually constructed the flying saucers or who were seeking contact with extraterrestrial life. For the most part, people welcomed him into their circles as he took photos and recorded stories about their experiences.
And most times they viewed me as a harbinger, a messenger from the aliens. I remember one fellow, Wayne Aho, who ran a group at the foot of Mount St. Helens. And I went down there. They were going to create a cosmic brain battery to summon UFOs to land and, you know, joining hands with this metal pyramid at the center of this sacred circle. And I just show up on the doorstep and say, "Hi, I'm Doug Kern. I'm from Canada. I'm looking for people's ideas about outer space." And I didn't have to qualify what those beliefs were or my position, but they would just say, you know, like Wayne Aho did, said, "Come in and knowing that if you're here, it's been preordained." So another time, I love this story. I was at a UFO convention in Reno, Nevada, and it's being held at the fairgrounds in the cattle barn. And so there's all these flying saucer people in this cattle barn still stinking of cow dung. And there's a big inflated flying saucer that someone's made out of Mylar at the end of the room. And I'm there photographing, and these two matronly women come up, and they're in their flower print dresses. I mean, they look like Iowa farm wives, right? And they said, "Can you tell us, where are you from?" And I said, "Well, I'm from Saskatchewan." They said, "No, we've been watching you beyond that." And I said, "Well, I'm just a photographer from Saskatchewan." And they said, "We're so glad to see you, and we want to help you with your work." And they shook my hand, and inside they pressed a $10 bill. And it was one of those things, at some point you just, they'd say, you know, "You've been told or you've been sent here." And I'd just say, "Yes, and I'm here to make the pictures."
Although he stopped recording those folk stories of UFOs and extraterrestrials, he says he still enjoys watching his work spin off in unexpected ways as people encounter his book.
Just this summer, I got sent word of a folk artist who was inspired by In Advance of the Landing. And this is an interesting story, because she grew up thinking that her father was a complete wacko and a source of embarrassment. They grew up poor, hardworking people. And she had viewed her family and her father with a lot of embarrassment until one day she came across my book. And it suddenly let her see him in a whole different light. And from that, she's burgeoned in her own career and done all these paintings about alien visitation that was formed this one-person show that was very highly regarded this past summer.
Chapter 4, The Artist.
My dad was building flying saucers in Texas, and I didn't really know other people who did that.
This is Esther Watson.
There was, I think, about four or five of them, and they were, he would start building them in the garage, and they were made, they were the elliptical shape, and they had an aluminum frame. He would create a frame, and then like one payday, he would show up with like giant roll of sheet aluminum instead of groceries, and then he would sheet and cover the entire saucer with aluminum. Some saucers he never finished. They would just have the framing on it, or they would have the propeller, and he would take the car engine out of our car and put it in the saucers to turn these propellers. But the irony is, he couldn't keep his cars running. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't put oil in the car, or you know, and then just like leave it on the side of the road, or. It'd run out of gas, or they were always breaking down, but he was building the future of transportation. I thought that was interesting.
She's an artist who now lives in California. She grew up in Texas. You might be familiar with her work. She's known for her graphic novel Unlovable, which was based on a found diary. She also paints landscapes of the places she lived as a child in Texas. Casually included in these calm pastoral scenes, though, are flying saucers hovering just above cows and children playing in fields.
A lot of times when I got older, I was very embarrassed. I tried to act like I had nothing to do with that, you know, and I would stay away from it. He put an office chair in one of them, and we would all sit in it. He was really big into taking pictures of Polaroids, a Polaroid camera, I think because he was so impatient to wait for the film to be developed. But he would take all these pictures with a Polaroid camera. Sometimes he would have us pose inside of it, and he would send these pictures, you know, to Ross Perot for funding, or, you know, whatever president was in office at the time, George Bush. Or and then sometimes he was going to get rid of it because it was, the design was flawed. But before he got rid of it, he wanted to make it look like a saucer crash. So he just kind of tilted it on its side and then crawled underneath it and had me take a photo with the Polaroid camera. And he had his pose. We don't have very many of those pictures because he either sent them off or, I don't know, we would move. We had to move often because the landlord didn't like him junking up the yard, or he would get in a battle with the town because of city ordinance. He would just make a big mess and get fined. And he also would tap electricity, he'd tap into the electric line so that he could weld, and because our electricity would get shut off and our water would get shut off, and he taught us kids, you know, how to turn the water back on if it ever got shut off.
When Esther eventually went away to school, the way she perceived her father changed. She stumbled across Doug's book.
And I was working in the library, and I came across Douglas Curran's book. And it was just filled with pictures all across the United States and Canada of people who, for whatever reason, built saucers. And sometimes, spacesuits, or my dad would build, he would make spacesuits as well. And so I was just like, oh my gosh, there's other people out there just like my dad. And it was kind of a relief in a way, because it was like, oh my gosh, I'm not alone. We're not alone. And because it was, you know, growing up, when, especially when I was a teenager, it was super embarrassing that he was doing this.
And suddenly, her father wasn't some weirdo that embarrassed her anymore. He was a visionary artist.
My sisters and I had run across Raw Vision magazine as well, and we saw that there was a name for this type of art. What we were calling art, because to me, I love to make art, so it felt like what he was doing was visionary art. And even though I think for him, he doesn't see it as art, I think he sees it more as like amateur engineering. We even, the American Folk Art Museum sent us over to Italy one time to pick up one of his saucers to bring it back for the museum. And he was kind of confused because he was like, well, are scientists going to be looking at this? And I'm like, no, it's just, you know, people going to this art museum. And so he made like the ugliest saucer because it was for artists. So I think to him it's very separate. But I consider it, for me, looking at it, it's visionary art. And similar to a lot of what visionary artists do. And I'm sure a lot of visionary artists think they're doing something different than what I'm calling art. But
Esther began incorporating flying saucers into her own paintings. It's a folky style, and her art is also known as outsider art.
I moved up to State New York with my husband and young daughter. I started painting these folk art New England landscapes, and I moved to California, and I realized I was inspired by a lot of the folk art up there, but when I helped California, there was no point for me to paint these New England landscapes, and I started painting Texas landscapes with the saucers. And I was looking at a lot of memory painters like Grandma Moses, who paint, you know, their childhood memories, even though they weren't perfect, but in an idealized way. And I really liked the idea of painting these childhood memories of dysfunction. And because we didn't really have we didn't have photo reference. And I like the idea of fallible memory, too, that, you know, I was trying to remember all the different houses. And it kind of started, too, when my dad sent me, he was sending me letters after I had moved to college. He moved back to Italy, and he started sending me letters, and he would draw on the top of this one batch of letters, had a drawing of each giant saucer that he had built, car-sized saucer. And I think there was five of them. And he would write underneath, you know, why he built that saucer. And in his letter, it was always like, somebody shut it down. Somebody else shut it down. Like, the city of Wiley did not want a flying vehicle. And so he had to discard that saucer. And but I remember different things. I remember it differently. And so I thought it was really interesting to paint my version, my memory of those incidents when he built a saucer. And then, you know, the city of Wiley got mad because he was tapping into the electric wires directly and blew up a transformer and was costing the city money. And he welded the wire so that, you know, he could turn it on. They couldn't turn it off. And he has, like, very different reasons and memories for why that happened. I kind of like that, exploring that.
Esther says she thinks she knows why her father was building those flying saucers all those years.
He was not into aliens at the time. This is the reason I think he built them. My dad was adopted from Calabria, Italy, when he was 7 years old, and he flew on a propeller plane to the United States, and later he made his way to Texas, and he was adopted by the Watsons, and grew up during the space race, and, you know, he had so much. He came from so little and had so much, and in high school, he was obsessed with building flying saucers because he saw that as the future of transportation. And in, like, after high school, he built a life-size one that he could fit in. And he had a teacher at it was like an engineering school in Arkansas that was kind of like a mentor to him. And he built one that the propeller turned, and he says it flew a little bit off the ground. I think it just kind of hovered. And then he built a bunch more that were car size, and they were always meant to be these prototypes for transportation. Hmm. And he never really talked about aliens, but he would sometimes. My mom would sew him spacesuits to protect him from negative ions. And but then sometimes he would go through a religious phase. He always kind of struggled with, you know, spending all this time working on this prototype and then, like, providing for his family. And so sometimes he would just scrap everything and then get a really good paying job and then become really very religious and try to stay on track.
And she has an idea of why he stopped building them.
But later in life, when he was in his mid-30s, he found his biological sister in Italy, and he moved back, and he moved all of us to Italy for a little while. And he kind of went back and forth for a little bit. And he eventually, after my parents divorced, he moved back permanently to be near his sister Rosa. And he, ever since he went back, he no longer builds those gigantic saucers. And for me, it was almost like this metaphor that he, like, built his own ship to go home. Make little experiments, and there is there's a community near Milan where he lives that they're more into UFO. They're into, like, aliens and UFOs, and you know, they would show interest in what my dad was doing and his experiments, and so he started talking about aliens more when he found when that group showed interest.
And now flying saucers are being passed down to another generation.
My daughter associates flying saucers with me, And she really likes imagery that has flying saucers on it because it means mom, which is so odd to me. And several times throughout her life, you know, I love to take these road trips, and we'll do, I started making these lady saucers, the pink glittery saucers. And I used glitter because my daughter, at the time I first started painting those saucers, was really very, like, girly and loved glitter. And she was associating saucers with me, and so I was making these, like, girly lady saucers. They're like mom saucers. And and I would paint these paper plates and paint them pink with glitter, and then we would go out, and she would throw them in the air. I'm like, throw it in the air again. She's like, Mom, this is getting boring. And I would take lots of pictures, and then I would paint sometimes from those pictures. And even just recently, when we went to Salvation Mountain, you know, we found a rock that somebody had painted pink, and I was like, throw this rock in the air. Like, do it again, do it again. She's like, Mom, it's getting boring. Come on, we go now. So I feel like, who knows, maybe she'll continue. It's become like a family legacy.
Yeah.
When we were in San Francisco, we went to Creative Growth, which is this really amazing foundation to help people with disabilities make art. And, you know, they can express themselves in all kinds of ways, you know, through sewing or cutting out shapes in wood and painting them, or just drawing. And they all have different reasons when you get to look at different, especially like outsider visionary or folk art or self-taught artists, you get to look at their work. They have this one message that they keep repeating and that they're talking about over and over. And I find that very relatable because I feel like my flying saucer paintings are very much like that as well. Like it's almost like repeating this memory or reframing a memory over and over and over. I totally understand. I think there's something really, I don't know, powerful in that outsider artists do that so openly. Like, they talk about something that is very important to them so openly. Whereas I feel like sometimes when some educated artists or artists that are in this have to kind of follow the establishment rules a little bit more and suppress their messaging or what it is they're trying to say.
Chapter 5, The Ones Who Watch the Sky. Granger and Esther's father, the people who call in to Art Bell's radio show, they're not alone. UFOBC.ca has a section with recently reported BC UFO sightings. It's updated monthly, and there is never a shortage of UFO sightings. The reports read like poetry. June 1st, 2016, Vancouver, BC, around midnight. There are about 7 or 8 orb-like lights, orange, red, and color, hovering over the ocean over Sunset Beach. They were moving in strange patterns, going up and down and back and forth. They were incredibly bright and would rise up, very high, and then fade out. Some would sink low and fade out. The whole event went on for about 20 minutes, with various orb-like objects appearing, moving around the sky in strange patterns, and then fading out. Can't explain it, and would love someone to take a look at the video and let me know what they think. It was truly breathtaking. Mid-February 2016, Nanaimo, BC. I have seen this a lot lately in Nanaimo. I noticed them in mid-February after I came home from work when it got dark, and I saw an orange light on the horizon towards the harbor. It was slowly hovering north, then another one appeared slowly beside it, then another one, then they disappeared in the same fashion. I see these lights often. I can distinguish the difference between planes coming in and these weird orange-yellow orb lights. 11th of June, 2016, Surrey, BC. Around 11 p.m., as my wife was about to retire for the evening on Saturday night, she observed a large spherical-shaped craft with lights around the periphery of the craft, visible through the evening's thin cloud cover as it hovered over Green Timbers Forest in Surrey. She said it appeared to be massive. It moved a little, but unlike any conventional aircraft, then slowly ascended further and further away until it was no longer visible at all. By the time she alerted me to what had happened, it had disappeared altogether. 13th of January, 2015. I saw six oval-shaped objects that appeared to drop out of the moon in the southwest sky. Each sped off in a northwest direction. The first appeared red, the second was darker and appeared to have a yellowish tail behind it. The next few appeared as dark ovals, but almost looked more triangular in shape as they sped away to the northwest. The first two ovals appeared to travel along the same line. The next few darker triangular shapes traveled in the same direction, but on slightly different paths. I honestly don't know what I saw. At first, I thought my eyes were deceiving me, but I was awake and lucid, outside having a cigarette and staring up towards the moon. There was a break in the fog, and I saw what I've described above. 20th of January, 2015, 19th February, Victoria, 2015, BC, Tagish Lake, Yukon. 16th of April, 2015, Balfour, 23rd BC. April, 2015, Fort St. James, BC. Three orange lights going up like a Roman candle in slow motion.
I saw a very bright light in the northwest sky.
Roughly tube-shaped object with red pulsating light in front, or direction of travel. Yellow to orange underside.
And on the
craft,
way home, I noticed something huge towards my right, just hovering in one spot, with lights all the way around. And when I asked
then
my friend
that
what that was,
early this morning while looking south above,
as I tried to drive back to the house south of one more that stayed in the same
I observed
spot,
what appeared to be a star.
And when I asked my friend what that was, she looked and asked the same thing.
So I tried to drive around.
It began for me when I located to get a picture, and it was gone.
I spoke with a member of Cowichan RCMP about Granger as a missing person. Corporal Krista Hobday told me over the phone that the detachment no longer had files on Granger, but she dug a little deeper and discovered that he's no longer considered a missing person. This is significant because missing person files are open until the person is found. However, I couldn't find a death certificate for him either. The fragment from a file she was able to pass on was a line or two about when his vehicle was found. It was blown to bits and human bone fragments were found amongst the debris. This led them to assume Granger Taylor was dead and the case was closed. There was no DNA testing done. Granger Taylor was a misunderstood man who wanted to join extraterrestrials on a journey through the universe. Esther Watson's father was searching for a way home. I think we're all looking for a little something extra in this life. A bit of magic to counterbalance the mundane and sad. And I think Doug sums it up the best.
When I set out to do the book, and people will ask me, well, do you believe in flying saucers? I said, I never cared about flying saucers. What interested me was the aspect of hope. It's the need to believe. And to find that same human need to believe, to frame our existence within a larger context, that interested me. That's what I wanted the book to do, to talk about this continuity of human need. And so the book's never been about whether or not flying saucers or alien beings exist. It's actually not very interesting to me.
Right.
What was interesting was this continuity of the human experience and this need for hope.
Yeah.
And, you know, all these people from Al Thomas who constructed a flying saucer to distribute food, medicine, and the Bible. When he's up there talking away in his Arkansas drawl and said, you know, I'll misquote from my book. It's been some years, some of this stuff. But he says, you can take airplanes, carbon arc welding, anything. But you get to the word of the Lord, that's got it all beat. And he's up there prancing around on this lopsided flying saucer that he's built out of scrap sheet metal and tubing from a junkyard. And he's connected to a bigger vision of his life in the world. And at some point, you know, I gained a lot of admiration for these people. Because while I didn't have to agree with their belief, I saw that it was ultimately, in one form or another, life-giving.
This was Beam Me Up, a documentary produced by me, Liz MacArthur. Thanks to the people whose voices are heard in the documentary. The clips at the beginning of the documentary are from recordings of Art Bell's call-in radio show, Coast to Coast AM, used without permission. This documentary was made possible with funding from CJSF 90.1 FM and the Canadian Radio Fund of Canada.